Thank you. It's intriguing for us to go to do a series together that links together. And Ben and I have been back and forth quite a bit trying to work out what to cover and what not to cover. So I was very excited by the time last night and what we learned there. Now, we don't usually at LaBrie lecture about surgically removing certain basic Christian doctrines from the Bible and from the faith, because we don't think that's a very good idea. But I'm going to kind of do that today, or flirt with doing that today, or at least relate to the culture which has done that big time. What if we remove the image of God from our view of the world and ways of living? I'm doing this not as a sort of hypothetical experiment with the sort of system of the cognitive system of Christianity, remove something and see what happens, but rather looking at society and the way we do life and the way we do democracy in the light of the role of this image of God. Is it there or not? And particularly, it's going to be much narrower than just the image of God as a whole, but it's going to be focusing very much on this idea of the biblical view of the image of God is that each person, part of it, this narrow piece that I'm picking up, has intrinsic dignity and value before God and before all of us, or ought to before all of us. If we were just dealing with the sort of the ideas of the Christian faith, this lecture would be very short, not sweet, but very easy. And I could end it right now by saying, if you remove the image of God, the whole web of Christian thought and reality falls to the ground in a pile of dust. There'd be nothing left of it to resurrect. This is because, having created us in his image and likeness, that image and likeness that we bear is the basis for the extraordinary value God places on us and the extraordinary love God has for us. It's totally tied to our identity as having been made in his image. Then you'd have to say the whole narrative of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation is an unfolding of that story of God's love for us, coping with our sin, our rebellion, back and forth and around. And so there would be no story. And so the lecture could end right now. And just saying the Christian faith is gone as a whole narrative of reality. But what I'm really interested in is not doing that, but in what's going on and has been going on around us for years. And promises, I think, to be a massive event in our future. What happens to a society that has been substantially, but imperfectly, built on the image of God, of each human individual being made in God's image, when that society starts to abandon that teaching, which has been one of the foundation stones under not just the United States, but Western democracy, founded on the respect for each individual as an individual. What happens? That's what I'm going to be wrestling with, not the niceties of juggling theological ideas. So let me just say a word about the historical significance of the image of God, the overlapping a tiny bit with what Ben said last night, but that's good because some of you were not here last night. The biblical witness is from the first chapter of Genesis, established that human beings are created in God's image and likeness, fearfully, wonderfully made and valued, which is just a teaching that's just carried on straight through the whole rest of the scripture. As Ben said last night, not articulated on every page with the nomenclature on image of God, likeness of God, but the assumption of human value is just vast. Most of the ethics in the whole Bible have to do, basically rest on the value of human beings and how we need to treat each other as people of value. We have the intrinsic dignity and value of each person, which does not depend on any of our achievements or capabilities, but on who we are as God's images. This dignity and value is not, and here again I'm just going to reflect a little bit on what we mean by intrinsic dignity and value, is not conferred on us by the state or by any other institution, by any who's who or any hall of fame or any achievement of celebrity or any membership in any race or social class. Intrinsic dignity means that we matter because we are precious to God, because we exist by creation in His image. Now, I'm going to reflect on this because it's really important that we get a grip on this as a foundation stone. If we have intrinsic human dignity, one of the implications of this is that we are equal in dignity and value with all the other human beings. If it's intrinsic to us, it doesn't depend on the differences between us. That means we're all the same in the sense that we're, in this primal sense that Ben talked about last night, most basic sense, that we're valued by God. That means human dignity is universal, constant, and important to God beneath all our human inequalities. It's not saying something so naive, it's just saying we're all just the same. This is because all people are equal to each other in the very thing that gives us our dignity, the valuation of God. I've been saying the same thing in three or four different ways to try and make sure we get it here. To say it one more way, to realize how radical this is, you must understand that there's no observable measure that you can use on people and you can use to measure people which shows us to be equal to each other. Any observable way you could measure us doesn't connect with this in-depth equality that is there, because it's in the sight of God, not just in our bodies, in our literary output, in our athletic performance, or whatever. So we're unequal and different from each other in every measurable scale. And that fact doesn't threaten what we've been saying about the intrinsic equality and of us all. So scales of intelligence, education, leadership, wealth, prestige, creativity, initiative, height, weight, sense of humor, how fast you can run, how well you can play the violin, all these things where we differ are measurable, but they are not touched by this deeper truth. The claim that the claim that people are equal, intrinsically equal in dignity and value, is into the teeth of and despite all the measurable differences by which we show ourselves to be unequal. Because we're equal in our intrinsic mattering in the sight of God. Martin Luther King captures a good angle on this in one of his sermons, saying that God's image gives every person, quote, a uniqueness, it gives him worth, it gives him dignity. And we must never forget this as a nation. There are no gradations in the image of God. There are no gradations in the image of God, which he's meaning the image of God in the sense Ben talked about last night in the most basic sense. Every man from a treble white to a bass black is significant on God's keyboard, precisely because every man is made in the image of God. Now, though that seems counterintuitive and maybe counter-experienced to us, how in the world did such an idea get started? It needs to be asked, and we've already answered this. Its truth rests entirely on Genesis 1, 26 to 28, and doesn't come. Stoics touched on it, but it doesn't come from this didn't come into modern democracy through Stoicism and its influence. It comes from the truth of Genesis 1, outweighing in importance all the ordinary human ratings, rankings, measurements, observations, and comparisons, where we show up different to each other. Okay? Okay, I've just been hammering that long enough, so I think you've probably got a grip on it. Looking at the history of Western culture, and this is ridiculous, it's insultingly brief, because I've struggled with much too much that I'd like to say this morning, and don't have time to say. to take Nicholas Waltersdorf, a professor at Calvin and then at Yale. He's done a major work on justice. He claims that you just don't see a respect for the individual in any political configuration apart from where it's been influenced by the doctrine of the image of God. You don't see the political reality respecting the individual as an individual apart from where that has been the case. He traces, and many others have, a very rocky path of medieval history as the Christian faith comes into a basically barbaric Europe, which is city-states and warlords and all this, each person, each little group running its own show, and being very a huge challenge from the Christian faith going into that world, and it takes a long time to have much of an influence. But it did. And overcoming political arrangements where, and not, this is not just in early or medieval Europe, but when you don't have the political system built on the image of God and the equality of all people, what is it built on? Well, he would say it's built on valuing people for their capacities, for their gifts, for what they can do, valuing people for their power, or the power of their families, or their money. And the big deal in sort of Greco-Roman religion, certainly, and Greco-Roman thought, into which the Christian faith has come, is the family was a value. And aristocracy, that means aristocracies, that means families that are important to have the power. Important people within the important families are the ones who really have to be paid attention to. We see a deep tradition there that has Paul challenges that. Well, the whole Bible challenges it, but you see Paul challenging that as teaching on what marriage and family is. It's under God. And it's in the whole teaching of the Christian way of life. Many implications of God's image into the political sphere you can trace back to the Reformation, which challenged the Roman Catholic hierarchy, gave the masses of people the Bible for the first time, so they could read it for themselves. Taught them to read, by the way, and stimulated interest in experimental science, and perhaps even behind all that, lifted up the importance of the individual in the sight of God. God doesn't just relate to the church as an institution, he relates to every single individual, and each individual can stand before God with the Bible in one hand and relate to God, even without the Bible in one hand, but relate to God. The English Reformation, particularly the 16th and 17th centuries, was very important in this regard, in the battles of the 17th century, the Puritan revolutions, producing a very different perspective on government. I think John Locke had great influence in England and also in this country because he would hammer very hard on the message that legitimate political power is not inherited, like through monarchies. Legitimate political power comes only with the consent of the governed. That has echoed around this neck of the woods a couple hundred years ago very, very, very loudly. And is what tilted us into a revolution. The legitimate political power is in the consent of the governed. That means the individuals who are being governed are the ones who have a say. No time to develop the role of the Reformation here, which was huge. In time, this overlaps with the movement called the Enlightenment, late 17th century, and mainly in flowering in the 18th century, a movement which had profound and diverse impact. And I can't do anything like justice this morning to the sort of sophistication of the variety of different ways the Enlightenment impacted our world. But it was fueled by a desire to throw off church authority, which had been in many ways abusive and authoritarian in the worst sense, as well as the authority of Aristotle in our universities, stifling any sense of any growth of science. It was the idea imbued by the newfound power of human investigation into all areas of life, without kings and priests looking over our shoulder. We want to look at the world, we want to investigate the world, we want to see what's there, we want to make theories on what we find that's there, and we want to learn from it. And going back to Francis Bacon, one of the main leaders in this, back in the 16th century, we want to do it because we want to help people. We want healthier people. We want to be able to have water brought here that isn't contaminated and makes people sick. We want to, and the whole beginning of the scientific revolution starts back then, but is with a deeply Christian and compassionate motivation. We want to investigate because we can make the world a safer place, a better place to live in. But through the Enlightenment, I mean, so many of the people who triggered it off were themselves very much Christians, as was Locke. But the power of it as it got going was that human experience is not in the it's human experience, not the revelation of God, that is our main source of meaning and authority. It's a reaction against authority in general, the authority of Aristotle, the authority of the Church, and the authority of the Bible. Getting into this whole movement, and we want to look ourselves at our world. Many people in the Enlightenment, particularly early days, did not disagree with Christian morality as such, but simply disagreed with the idea of needing the Bible to have Christian morality. We know that people are valuable. We know that it's good to love people and so on. We don't need the Bible to tell us this. These moral truths, we can know them from human reason and human experience. So, our founding fathers in this country put together a nation, or just you can just look at the Declaration of Independence, which we're going to be looking at quite a bit this morning. And this was put together and signed by people who were both Christians and children of the Enlightenment. People like Jefferson was very much a child of the Enlightenment. And a mixture of different perspectives. But holding enough together that they could agree on some basic things of what was important. Intrinsic human dignity was part of what they held on to from the Christian faith, but also Jefferson as a deist. And so he could write in the Declaration, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men were created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." He could not say we hold these truths because God's revelation tells us in the Bible, because he didn't believe in the Bible as a revelation of God. So he wanted to affirm the truths, those same truths, but he didn't want to have to depend on the Bible to get a hold of those truths. So he just called them self-evident, even though there are few things so little self-evident as the truth I've just tried to lay. What I've told you this morning is that in any evidential measure, the people come out looking differently from each other, come out unequal to each other. But never mind. Admittedly, he struggled with this, and with Franklin and Adams, who struggled working out the Declaration, editing it, finally to know what to say. But we're left with the idea that you can know this by intuition or some means. So the Declaration could be written by, and my point is, the Declaration could be written by and signed by its signers, many of whom believed in the Bible and in Christian theology, but those who did not, but who were deists or people of the Enlightenment, who didn't believe the Bible, had such an exposure to a Christian culture and a Christian heritage for such a long time, hundreds of years going into their backgrounds, that they had been profoundly influenced by the Bible, so that they, like Jefferson, believed in an intrinsic human dignity. That is, they believed in what the Bible taught, but without the Bible, because of the tremendous impact. And many of the teachings of the Enlightenment are unthinkable without them having rested on the Bible at the start. But the Enlightenment grew to be a direct challenge to the Christian faith. Some of it staying in the church and undermining biblical authority within the church, and some by embracing an aggressive atheism. This is by the 19th century particularly. We deal today with some of the people who Paul Ricoeur called the masters of suspicion, who were Feuerbach, Marx, Darwin, Nietzsche, and later Freud, planting not just suspicion of God, but suspicion of human knowing itself and its reliability, the whole process of human knowing. It's through them that we've had a major attack, direct attack, on the Christian faith, which I think has hit, we talk about this a lot in our international Libri meetings, the European branches of Libri feel this has hit much harder in Europe than it has in this country, and I think that's definitely true, and the force of the thinking of these men. Now I want to turn more onto the impact of what this has done. Can we have the image of God without God? It was not first the idea of the image of God that was attacked. It was God himself. But without God, what becomes of God's image? It becomes some sort of an illusion floating in midair that can only be misleading to us. But that's not a simple question. What becomes of the image of God is a very complicated and diverse consequence. Because it turned out, I think you could put it this way, that it's been much easier for people to throw out God than it has been for them to throw out the human identity that came with us being in his image. So people have thrown out God, but they've hung on for dear life to aspects, at least, of what it is to be in his image. We would say, why aren't they consistent and destruct the whole thing? Well, that's because they're actually made in the image of God and can't bear to throw away what is so basic. I'm going to read a couple of things here on this, but I want to read to you Nietzsche's account of the death of God. This is something that you've probably, some of you have read anyway, but if you haven't, you ought to, and because it's so important and so powerful. Here he's clearly an atheist. This is in his book Gay Science, although he puts this some equivalent of this narrative in a number of places. It just starts with the madman. Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace, and cried incessantly, "I seek God! I seek God!" As many of those who did not believe in God were standing around just then, he provoked much laughter. "Has he got lost?" asked one. He's got these people sounding like Elijah at the Mount Carmel. "Has he got lost? Did he lose his way like a child?" asked another. "Or is he hiding? Is he afraid of us? Has he gone on a voyage? Emigrated?" Thus they yelled and laughed. The madman jumped into their midst and pierced them with his eyes. "Whither is God?" he cried. "I will tell you. We have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. How did we do this? How could we drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What were we doing when we unchained this earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we not plunging continually, backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there still any up or down? Are we not straying as through an infinite nothing? Do we not feel the breath of empty space?" And he goes on in this way, just asking question after question of how could we have done such a thing? Because everything comes unhinged. And then here the madman fell silent and looked again at his listeners, and they too were silent and stared at him in astonishment. At last he threw his lantern on the ground and broke it into pieces and went out. "I've come too early," he said. "Then my time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. Lightning and thunder require time. The light of stars requires time. Deeds, though done, still require time to be seen and heard. This deed is still more distant from them than the most distant stars, and yet they have done it themselves." Now, I had no time to to take that apart. First of all, he doesn't mean literal murder of God. He means turning away from God, turning away from the need for God, a culture-wide abandonment of God as the source of meaning and authority. and putting human sensibility and experience in its place. Notice that the madman spoke of when the madman spoke of the disappearance of God, they laughed and made fun of him. When he spoke of God's death and its consequences, he pierced them with his eyes, and they were silent, staring with astonishment. He said that the result of the death of God, who gave us the sponge to wipe away the horizon? What were we doing when we unchained the earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither are we moving? Away from all suns? Are we plunging continually backward, sideward, forward, in all directions? Is there any up or down? Now, what he's doing here is saying, you see, you've killed God, and you have unhinged all the systems of meaning that have been holding your lives together, and you don't have a clue. Nietzsche saw more clearly than most people. You remove God, and you remove the basic building blocks of meaning, which have come through us through centuries-long reflection and dependence and living on God's word. Let me just step out of this for a second. Words are differentiators. This is looking at some of the postmodern work has done, which is very valuable. Words differentiate. They only work as we talk to each other because they differentiate one thing from another. When I say piano, you don't think of something with wings. If you see something with wings, you know it's not a piano. Okay? If I'm talking about a dog, you're not going to think of headlights. Because the word dog differentiates it, that what I'm talking about, from anything that might have headlights. Because you have a fixed idea of dog differentiated from... You see what I'm trying to say? Words are differentiators. The Christian faith and all of Christian theology lays out for us some of the most basic differentiations that we can have. God, human, different from each other. Animal, different still. And mineral, say rocks. All different from each other. And we know that. We have that laid out and grounded in the Bible. In the scripture. God, human, animal, rock, and so on. Good from evil are differentiated in the Bible and articulated. Grounded, given a foundation, and are articulated in terms of what they mean. The differences between God, human, animal, and rocks are lost if you remove God from the picture. The difference between good and evil are lost without God. So we're in floating midair, spinning, turning, with no stable point of reference, no up, no down. This is what Nietzsche is nailing, and he understood this much better than most people, and much better than most Christians. Even how total their dependence is on the basic groundwork of Christian building blocks of reality. The madman's listeners don't believe in God, and they were laughing and joking at first, but they hear about the consequences of God's death, and they are shocked, shaken, astonished, bewildered. They can't take it in. And then he says, I've come too early, my time is not yet. This tremendous event is still on its way, still wandering. It has not yet reached the ears of men. What an amazing prophecy. This is Nietzsche as prophet, because he's absolutely right. People who were willing to reject God were not willing to reject the consequences of rejecting God, have been hanging on desperately to all sorts of bits and pieces of the Christian faith without God behind them that they needed to hold their lives together. And again, the image of God is one. This is why it's not simple. You lose God, you lose his image. No, you lose God, you lose a real grasp on his image. But you keep hanging on to things that will give you the sense that his image gave you. Some notion of value, some notion of human distinctiveness. Again, what an amazing prophecy. Our society still, 150 years after Nietzsche wrote this, won't take this seriously. As seriously as the madman did, because it's too shocking, too stabilizing. So you have you lose God, but you have a totally ambivalent notion about God's image. So it's God who places us as his image. He gives us what Ben was talking about last night in describing the image of God. He differentiates us, to get back to that notion of the function of words. He differentiates us upward and downward. differentiated upward in that we are not God. We are God's creatures. We are not gods. We are made by God. We're not gods ourselves. We are stepping way out of line in outright rebellion if we when we take on the prerogatives or authority of God. We are his valued, loved creatures made in his image, not gods ourselves. We're differentiated also downward in that we're not animals or sticks or stones. We have far greater. You have far greater value than the gravel outside in the road, because that's not made in God's image. It's God's created gravel, but it's not. You have enormous value, more value than the gravel does in the sight of God. We know our place in the world, up and down. You remove God and his word, and we are adrift without these distinctions. Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said that we are of no greater value than a grain of sand or a baboon. What in the world could give you a grunt? He's an atheist. There's no reason to say there's no God in the picture. Why in the world would a human being be of greater value than a grain of sand or a baboon? Because the radical differentiation between human and baboon and sand is groundless without God, without the God who made it. Shirley MacLaine, on the other hand, claimed that she was God herself. And without God, in what God's word, God's revelation, who's to say that either of them are wrong? You need God. You need some way of grounding these differentiations to know that they're both, that we have a way to make those distinctions. They're both wrong. So much of our society has, what much of our society has done is to let God go, but to retain what it means to be in his image. Or we've tried to retain it, to keep each individual having great intrinsic dignity and value. And Nietzsche poured scorn on those who would refuse to do this. He got into it, some of you have probably tracked with this. He had great scorn for the Victorian English novel, which we think is, these wonderful novels came out of Victorian England, particularly George Eliot, or actually Marian Evans. He had special scorn for her because she didn't believe in the Christian God, which she didn't, but she had high moral Christian values in her stories and great respect for those who lived out those values. Just read something like Middlemarch. It's a wonderful account of someone having very high values and being a beautiful person, living it out. He had absolute scorn for her because she wouldn't go all the way. She wouldn't go throw God away, but then she needed to hold on to these ideas of Christian morality. We want it desperately at a psychological level, with a therapeutic revolution where each person is meant to experience their own value and feel good about themselves. Everybody's meant to feel good about themselves, period. We want it all in a framework where everybody somehow knows right from wrong, good from evil. Though it's a world where there's no ground for actual obligation. And who knows? Maybe Oliver Wendell Holmes is right. You have no more value than a grain of sand. That's what someone like Tim Keller has looked at the therapeutic revolution and the tremendous interest in psychology, and saying you look at the self-help shelves in a bookstore, and you see endless books written on technique of how to feel better about yourself and how to be more integrated as a person and so on. No one dares touch the deep issue that could you have no meaning whatsoever in your life? Because they don't have an answer to that. And so all the psychological issues are dealt with through much of modern popular psychology, at least, without daring to look at the real issue, underlying issue, is that it could be that human beings have no greater value than a grain of sand, and people begin to realize it, and lo and behold, that leads to depression, that leads to anxiety, and so on. So it's not the only thing going on there. But you see what I'm saying is that there's a desire to get at, to fix us, to make us feel better, and so on, but not to raise this bigger issue that is screaming at us from the lower story. We want fruit which comes from being in God's images, in his world, but without God himself. Oz Guinness calls this a cut flower society. A cut flower society. And you can see where he's going with this. Cut flowers are beautiful. But, you know, they don't last that long. Why? Because they're cut from their roots. They're not. They don't have roots there anymore. And you can't expect them to last without the roots. And we've built, looking at the roots of our society, but we've cut the God off who supplies those roots. We're not connected to the roots anymore. Or people have used other illustrations. We try to live off our spending your capital investments, or spending your, say, moral capital, which is finite. How can we be go on living on this forever, which we can't? Or another angle on this, Richard Rorty, not at all a Christian, a postmodern pragmatist philosopher, had a phrase he called freeloading off God. And that's what someone does who doesn't have any ground for Christian hope or Christian realities, but needs some of these ideas that come only from God. So they freeload off God just by brazenly bringing in Christian ideas and patching them in to the rest of their lives. And he says, I do this myself. I'm happy to do this. He could, actually, from within his philosophical framework, he can do that. But still, there's an obvious honesty problem there. What is really true, and what are we doing with what is true? We want this politically. We want to keep that all men are created equal, and they're endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. You know, I've lectured, as some of you who've suffered through these, a number of times, looking at the First Amendment in the last couple of years. I've read a bunch of books on the First Amendment. The interesting thing to me is that writing, the First Amendment a little bit, but more on the Declaration of Independence, and particularly the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. People are deeply embarrassed as they reflect on it. They love it. They think this is the important thing to affirm. Deeply embarrassed, and they skip over the created and creator. I'll just let you have a look at this. It says created equal, and their creator, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. The fact that there's a creator in there is deeply embarrassing to many political theorists today. And almost everybody that comes out, they skip over that. They want to say, well, you know, of course all men are equal, because they really are equal. And we have these rights because we function better, we thrive when we have these rights. But we don't need God as a foundation. What they're saying is basically we don't want to need God as the foundation of our favorite political convictions. We don't want to need God for this. And yet, God is there, darn it. Even it was Jefferson's God, maybe, but God is there, and you take God out of that, and as we'll see in a few minutes, you run into real trouble. They just assume that people are equal, or that they just because they thrive better with rights, those rights are really there. But you know, rights have to be given by somebody. Rights don't. How do you come by rights? If you want rights, how do you ever come by them? They have to be granted to you by someone who has the authority to grant them to you. Anyway, I want to shift now to a person who isn't a Christian, but who has a deep sense of the reality of the questions that I'm talking about, and more. He's a Jewish historian, Israeli historian, a guy called Yuval Noah Harari. Written in the last couple of years, two 400-page books, which make my head ache. But they're really very, very interesting books. He's an atheist, but in an unusual way, because he keeps all the questions open. He doesn't want to put questions under the carpet. And he believes that one of the... I'm having to go on a little bit of a sidetrack here to get where I'm wanting to go. He believes that one of the distinctive abilities of the human beings is having imaginations that can invent myths, illusions, and fictions that are shared by sufficiently large numbers of other people that they are sort of an entity to themselves. For example, his primer example is the value of money. What in the world gives money its value? people swallow the collective fiction that bits and pieces of colored paper somehow have enormous real-world value. That even electronic blips flying around the world in cyberspace can transfer real wealth. Real wealth meaning to buy land, to build houses, to not just some sort of fictional mystical existence, but real wealth. He says all this only works because people trust in the fiction that money has value. And you've got to grant him his point. It's not just because we're off the gold standard, because you could ask the same questions about gold as the early Latin Americans asked the Spanish as they came, and they noticed they were so fantastically dominated by gold. And they would ask the Spaniards, why is gold so important? Because they had gold all over the place. And why? what's the big deal? It's actually pretty useless metal. You know, it's too soft. It's too soft to make tools out of. You can't, and it's too weak to do much of anything with. What's the deal? And one description is of, well, we have this, basically said, we have this real neurosis we're born with. We have to have it and need more of it. That's all the Spaniard could come up with. I think that was Cortez or someone like that, or one of his folks. But you could say the same thing about a nation. I mean, he does say the same thing about a nation. Nations are also collective illusions, because a nation, people die for their nation. That's happening all the time. But what are they? Are they just the land? No, they're not just the land. Are they the people? No. He points out that the USSR was a nation. Now it's not a nation anymore. Because people no longer believed in it. Its fictional status has been lost. And is no longer a nation. Now, he then goes on to say that God and universal moral principles are similar illusions. So, as I said, he's an atheist. God is a similar illusion, similar fiction. Entirely fictional, but they function to hold society together because people believe in them, and as long as people believe in them. So, a supposedly universal principle about, for example, human equality is also just a fiction. And he writes, is there any objective reality outside the human imagination in which we can be truly equal? Are all humans equal to one another biologically? And to illustrate this, he makes a translation, which I'm going to read to you, even though it's reading a little bit more than a page of his book, because it's very interesting. We talk often about scientific reductionism. In other words, looking at someone only through the eyes and something that's very rich and complex only through the eyes of one science, let's say. And it's very easy in our society to believe that because it's science, it's the real truth, it's the objective truth. See what you think when we get through with this. He's taking the Declaration of this paragraph in the Declaration, this paragraph here, which includes theological assertions, universal norms about human nature, people's rights, and the path to a good life. And he reduces it to what can be said objectively, which for him means the categories of biology. Okay? And I'm going to read to you his process of thought in doing this, not just, I'll show you the final result in a minute, but his process of thought. According to the science of biology, people were not created, they have evolved. And they certainly did not evolve to be equal. The idea of equality is inextricably intertwined with the idea of creation. The Americans got the idea of equality from Christianity, which argues that every person has a divinely created soul and that all souls are equal before God. However, if we do not believe in the Christian myths about God, creation, and souls, what does it mean that all people are equal? Evolution is based on difference, not on equality. Every person carries a somewhat different genetic code, and is exposed from birth to different environmental influences. This leads to the development of different qualities that carry with them different chances of survival. Created equal should therefore be translated into evolved differently. Just as people were never created, neither, according to the science of biology, is there a creator who endows them with anything. It's only a blind evolutionary process, devoid of any purpose, leading to the birth of individuals. Endowed by their creator should be translated simply into born. Equally, there are no such things as rights in biology. There are only organs, abilities, and characteristics. Birds fly, not because they have a right to fly, but because they have wings. It is not true that these organs, abilities, and characteristics are unalienable. Many of them undergo constant mutations and may well be completely lost over time. The ostrich is a bird that lost its ability to fly. So unalienable rights should be translated into mutable characteristics. And what are the characteristics that evolved in humans? Life, certainly, but liberty? There's no such thing in biology. Just equality, rights, and limited liability companies. Liberty is something that people invented and that exists only in their imaginations. From a biological viewpoint, it's meaningless to say that humans in democratic societies are free, whereas humans in dictatorships are unfree. Let me read that sentence again. From a biological viewpoint, it's meaningless to say that humans in a democratic societies are free, whereas humans in dictatorships are unfree. And what about happiness? So far, biological research has failed to come up with a clear definition of happiness or a way to measure it objectively. Most biological studies acknowledge only the existence of pleasure, which is more easily defined and measured. So, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness should be translated into life and the pursuit of pleasure. And then he lays out what the translation is, and these are the two. This is Jefferson on the top, and Harari's translation into biological on the bottom. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men evolved differently, that they are born with certain mutable characteristics, and that among these are life and the pursuit of pleasure. Full stop. The Declaration itself, you see, is a theologically grounded call to an absolutely radical social commitment and political commitment, demanding enormous changes to the way things are, the way people are treated, the way things are normally done. As we know, the country has done poorly living out these basic truths on this paragraph, appallingly poorly. But despite those failures, I would want to argue, we've done better than if this document hadn't been there at all as a goal that we're aiming for. Okay? Because we are fallen creatures and we're broken and bent. And so we don't. This, the idea of human equality, in fact, and living out and living in a way that respects human equality in the radical way that the Bible says, is a challenge into the teeth of pride, of human pride. Pride, we want to stand above other people. We will use anything to put ourselves above people in our own minds, in our social settings, and so on. So it's a huge challenge to pride itself. So it shouldn't surprise us that it's difficult to put it into action, and it sure enough has been difficult. Martin Luther King saw this paragraph, which is a marvelous insight, I think. He says, "This is an uncashed check to African-American people." This paragraph of the Declaration, an uncashed check to African-American people. And when you think of it, he gave his life trying to get this check to the bank, and he made some real progress in doing it. Now, in Harari's translation into biological, it has become absolutely bland and flat-footed Darwinian description of the human condition without any moral or political significance whatsoever. As he knew perfectly well, Harari is not being surprised. He says, "You're going to be outraged by this and indignant about it." I wasn't, because he was saying exactly what I'd been saying for ages, is that without God, what in the world is this doing? What are we doing with this here if there's no creator? Why do we mouth these things and think we've done something significant politically or morally? But he knew perfectly well, you remove creator, God, from the Declaration, and the images, and his image is gone as well, with all its claims and obligations to us. This statement here that he's translated would never have fired up a revolution, and it only would have confused poor George III. Wouldn't have known what to make of it. Okay, going on here. Back to our Jack Miles. I'll just briefly. This is an example. He's a professor of English at University of California. He was general editor of the new Norton Anthology of World Religions. But his attitude is more kind of it comes through as flippant academic. In a sort of a playful tone, he asks, does anyone really believe that all men and women are created equal? But recognizing the delusional premise of American democracy doesn't undermine faith in it. Let me read that again. Does anybody really believe that all men and women are created equal? But recognizing the delusional premise of American democracy needn't undermine faith in it. See, he's got the sense to know that from where he's standing, he's saying that all men and women having been created equal is a delusional premise of American democracy. He has a perfect right to this belief. He's not sure that there's any God there at all. And if there is no God, then he's right. Then it's a delusional premise of American democracy. But his extraordinary faith is that it won't make any difference if America knows that it's a delusion. I would say America's not willing to admit that it's a delusion, has no reason to say anything else, but doesn't want to admit that it's a delusion, given how little they believe from God. I think it's a naive faith. Because equality in this necessary idea is all in good shape, this necessary idea for living democracy, but we don't really need to believe it to be true. To believe in equal dignity of all people and to take that seriously at every level of life is an extremely costly matter to anyone who takes it seriously and who does it. It's not a little fun game to play. It will reshape every one of our individual lives, let alone any kind of political influence we may exert. Thomas Jefferson, who wrote the Declaration of Independence himself, did not have the courage or the conviction himself to get anywhere near putting it into practice. He died with 350 slaves who he did not free, even in his will. And he was admittedly in conflict over this. And he wrote in a different thing. We don't know exactly where he was coming from, but he wrote of his own frustration with this. But it would have meant the collapse of his beautiful lifestyle at Monticello. And if you've been to Monticello and looked around there, you can see, wow, he had a lifestyle to protect. But where does that leave him with the very thing that he's written? You know, it's just heavy, heavy going. And so it's not something we can just say, oh, yes, this is for constructing governments off somewhere. It's an enormously important to the way we live. And this goes all the way down to our individual relationships. You see, I don't believe it's a delusion at all. I believe it's true. I can and do believe in the intrinsic dignity of all people, but only because I believe there's a personal God there who has us, who's made us all in his image, and who establishes the equal dignity and worth of everybody. Think of how the whole biblical witness, think of the witness of the prophets. How do they evaluate a nation? Surprisingly, it was not by checking up on how do you treat the rich folks in your society. That's not how Amos works. It's not how Micah works. It's not how Jeremiah or Isaiah worked. They asked, how are you treating the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner? Those who have no wealth and power. How do you treat the fatherless and the refugee? That's the way you know where a country stands. That's the way you know what their values are and how they work, rather than how they treat the rich. Because if you don't treat the rich well, they know how to get back at you. And not so the poor, the disenfranchised. Think of Jesus teaching about how we treat the least of these, our brethren. And as we treat the least of these, we treat him. The church at its best has taken that deeply, deeply seriously. The early church emphasis on hospitality radical hospitality, which is one of the main ways they grew, reasons they grew, was in taking this Matthew 25 passage literally, that in entertaining people who are poor and in desperate need, so on, we may be treating Jesus himself. And Jesus teaching himself, the last will be first and the first will be last. That means all the scorekeeping, as I call it today, of Wall Street Journal, People Magazine, Fortune, Sports Illustrated, all the big magazines, will be shown to be completely wrong in what they value. Upside down, not just missing the boat a bit, but upside down in terms of what really is of ultimate value. Again, I don't feel that I do very well in my own life putting this together, being able to live this out, but it is a glorious goal to move toward. It is a glorious path to be on, even though every single one of us will fail to get very far down the road to be really like Jesus. It's a glorious road to at least set out following. My struggle is when I see how hard it is to live up to this truth for those of us who do believe it to be true. And how, because of our sin, so often we do it poorly despite having convictions that it is right. How do we expect those who don't believe it to somehow respect these deep truths of democracy? Those who believe it to be a fiction or a delusion, that all people are equal. Is it realistic to put faith in their likelihood of following this? Okay, the future. I'm not a fan of futurology, but this guy, Yuval Noah Harari, has written another book. His second book is called Homo Deus, meaning man-god, a brief history of tomorrow. I want to throw out some of his predictions, which are just interesting. And I do it because they're short. They're not way into the future sci-fi kind of predictions, but they're predictions that have some likelihood. He would say, and this is what I'm trying to, I'm doing this because I think this is, it could be that what he's writing is what's going to be coming at us. And what I'm trying to say is that this truth is really going to be under fire. Really going to be under fire by what we will face. Maybe not what I will face, but what my children and grandchildren will face. He would say, human beings are in danger of losing their value because, and this is an interesting idea to get hold of, intelligence is increasingly disconnected from consciousness. As he said, there have been big advances in computer intelligence, no advances in computer consciousness. We are conscious. We can't for the life of us explain how consciousness has come into being. He trashes all scientific attempts to explain human consciousness, but says we can do all sorts of things to explain what works as intelligence and intelligence getting, but intelligence without consciousness. Computers are increasingly doing what only conscious persons used to do and are now doing those jobs, many of them better than conscious people did them. Think of the victories of computers in chess and then just this last year in the Korean game of Go, which is definitely more taxing still. Driving cars, identifying terrorists, or more close to home, taking tolls on the Mass Pike. No people out there anymore. And he's arguing here that we're going into a time where people, consciousness, is going to be irrelevant. Not entirely relevant, but relatively so. Given the growth of automation and robotics, most human beings, this is his view, will be losing their usefulness. And so the economic and political system will stop attaching value to them. How often, this is me, not him, but how often economic advances, breakthroughs, and so on, are measured by how many employees we can do without. We can remove from the necessary process of doing operating our business. The mergers, the consolidations, and so on, are so often, well, we could lay off this many people. Harari says, this is, I have no idea how to make sense of this, that by 2050, 60% of our population will be economically and politically irrelevant. I think he also means unemployed. I don't know what to do with that, but again, I see that as there's some direction in that I see going on around us all the time. I ran across a cartoon not long ago that had a man coming into the United States Department of Labor. And he comes into this big room, and there's a desk there. And behind the desk, there's no one, Evan, except behind the desk, there is a robot. And the United States Department of Labor. He predicts two kinds of humanism replacing today's dominant liberal humanism. What is our time schedule? Do you know our how? When are we meant to end?
Theoretically having a tea break at 10:45, which is in 3 minutes.
Okay, that answers my question.
You started a little late.
Yeah, well, I'll limit it. I can come back to something in discussion if I need to. He has an interesting account of the Enlightenment being replaced. Introducing a humanism as the basic religion, then humanism dividing itself into three parts. I may talk about that in the discussion if people are interested. But he says now we have, the surviving humanism left, he calls liberal humanism, which is what we see all around us today, he says that is being destroyed by its own technology and science. In other words, liberal humanism, freedom, individual work and his value and her value and so forth. But he says the science and technology we're developing showing that freedom is totally illusory, that we are determined completely by biological electronic forces and so on. And also we're beginning to be able to control people entirely. So freedom and this great myth of liberal humanism is just is going to be turning to dust. Left will be techno-humanism and data religion. He sees techno-humanism coming out of medicine and brain science, whose cutting edge will be less healing and more enhancement. Do you get that? It's going to be he says we solve the basic diseases and so on. I'm not quite sure what he thinks of cancer and things like this, medicine, the cutting edge of medicine will be more in direction of enhancement through nanotechnology, genetic enhancement, brain and brain-computer interface. The challenge will be to get humans as close to God as they can, seeing immortality as within their reach. I mean, if some of you are familiar, Ray Kurzweil, his work, not just a cult, weird cult hero from off somewhere, he is one of the main engineers in Google now. But he believes that what he's working toward is to be able to download human intelligence or human consciousness onto a computer, and then we'll be immortal, and our body can die, and that won't make any difference because we'll be alive on the computer. I said it. A techno-humanism that's very much into human enhancement. Then there will be data religion. Data will know so much more about us than we could ever know ourselves that we will trust data as God. It will know more about what we feel than we do ourselves. So it will be a reliable guide in our choices. They quote someone at Facebook claiming that if you have liked 300 or more things, we can be better at predicting your opinions than your spouse. Than other things. Other people will say that's absolute rubbish. They don't anywhere as much. Anyway, I have no idea what the truth or not of it is at, but that's what's being thrown at us. That's what's being hoped. You could certainly sell a lot of advertising by if that's true. But a few people will need to understand and write the algorithms for this, but the rest of us will follow along, he would say. Traditional religion, like Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and so on, will still be around, but it will be in a rear guard operation, taking no cultural leadership as it once did. Harari says what we, and being maybe for some people an anchor, but not doing what is needed in society, which will be to provide a rudder and a map, which we don't have. I have no idea of the accuracy of these predictions, but there's a certain trajectory here that I can see going on around us, a certain continuity with that, and problems that I can already see. If anything challenges, if anything like this is coming, what does it mean for us? The world is not standing still. We're already, it's boiling all around us right now. We're already very weak in our treatment of people at both ends of life. The unborn and the elderly. It will put enormous pressure on the very Christian ideas that have transformed Western culture in the last 1500 years. I can't have any like time to go into this, but there will be all sorts of pressure points that will be under attack. My hope and my prayer is that Christian people will be players in this discussion, not just in flight from the whole discussion. That we would not just look for an anchor for our flock, but we would try to provide or get into the discussion of maps and rudders. In other words, he predicts that the traditional religions will not have anything like the role that, say, the Christian faith did in the rise of science and the rise of democracy. He gives the Christian faith, unusual, a credit, I think, for the rise of science and the rise of democracy. But he says that the Christian church will not be having any such influence. I want to think of certain sort of pressure point kind of Christian areas that I really want us and the Christian church to really wrestle with what's clearly coming at us. One question that Harari has touched on, or actually touches on a lot in his books, is what is the meaning of life? What will happen to this question? This is a question that I don't think is going to go away. However much laughter it gets, however much scorn it gets from people who think it's just a naive question. I think what will happen to this question, the question to me is the question, what will happen to this question in a world where everything that seems to matter is described in the languages of biology or economics? And when this is what reality is, okay, what sort of meaning comes out of biology and economics for us? Harari himself sees the problem. He says, modern life consists of a constant pursuit of power within a universe devoid of meaning. And he doesn't write that in celebration at all. He feels the huge gap that's there. The need for meaning will keep bursting out into the world from every which corner, expected and unexpected. There's going to be a lot of pushback from the non-Christian world, because what the new humanisms will offer will be so inadequate, unjust, and anti-human. Biblical faith is a rich source of getting a grasp of meaning. Everything that Harari claims in the terms of the future points to a massive, this is one of the basic things that I think we need to really reflect on as Christians, a massive growth in elitism in the future world. The separation of people from each other, the loss of the intrinsic dignity of every person, or at least great pressure put to devalue all but the most exceptional individual. Exceptional individuals are going to get big playing time and big time power. The exceptionally bright, exceptionally whatever, is medical enhancement in all its forms will certainly be for the rich and powerful. The elite, to make them more elite still, they and their children. Harari wrote that in 2016, which is when his last book was published, there were 62 billionaires in the world who own more than the bottom 50% of the entire world population. I referenced this in the lecture I gave out in Minnesota just this last week at a conference. And as I was leaving the lecture room, this guy holds up his computer to me. And I think as people are typing on their computers when they're listening to you lecture, they're taking notes, right? No, they're fact-checking. And he says, Oxfam says it's only 8 billionaires. Who knows? Who knows? I have no idea. But conceivably, only 8 billionaires own as much as the entire bottom 50% of the world population. I have no idea which is true there, but it probably has to do with how you count billionaires. any case, the biblical teaching on intrinsic dignity of every human being, having equal value in the sight of God as his image and likeness, is going to be desperately needed and called for, but also heavily under fire, with enormous economic pressures against it. I just heard, this was either yesterday morning or the day before, Harvard and MIT won a legal case, patent case against Berkeley, for some super accurate technology for DNA editing, which they say would be worth tens of billions of dollars to whoever gets this patent. I scarcely know what that means, but tens of billions of dollars? Like most technology, it will have a potential for good and for abuse. It will be a two-edged thing. I think coming at us will be a rise in eugenics. And that's really what eugenics, the idea of you, good, gene. Good gene. There's good genes, and we want to stimulate those. We don't want so much about the rest of them. Hitler did more than anyone else to sink eugenics, which was a lively operation at Harvard, Yale, and Stanford. Harvard particularly took major leadership in eugenics between about 1900 and in the late 1920s. Totally mixed in racism, but I don't see why we're not going to see this, but not under that name. And not under the you'll see it kept within some sort of politically correct lingo. I think this is huge. This is why I'm so glad that we've got Adam speaking this afternoon and working with people who are disabled. And this is doing that and valuing that is a sermon about the image of God, because this is. These are people we value, who are not making it in the world today as everybody else is. But that's awesome, and I'm so glad you're here to do that. But it's totally integrated to what we're trying to do here. Anyway, glad for that. I'm suggesting that there'll be great importance to certain Christian teachings in real-life experience. I've mentioned the meaning of life, human dignity and equality. I also want to say work. We've got to think about work. What does work mean? How will we do it? What's going to happen if people start, if we get anywhere near what he's predicting here? How will we understand work? What is the connection between work and being in the image of God? What leadership can Christians do in society if this is happening around us? Family is going to be enormously under stress because of social changes that could happen if any of these ideas come with anywhere. Community, all these are things that I want to see lots and lots of discussion among Christians about. You see, what I want to get it free from is this idea that the Christian faith will only be doing a rear guard operation protecting its own flock. But we would be in the middle of some of these battles and discussions around issues so that we would not just be an anchor, but be part of the mapping and the ruddering of the world. I hope so. If that happens, it will be, I would say, only because Christian people have really wrestled with these topics and others creatively, imaginatively, theologically, practically, prayerfully, together, and over time. Let me say that again, because it's a mouthful. It will only happen because Christians have wrestled with these creatively, imaginatively, theologically, practically, prayerfully, together, and over a period of time. Okay. What I've tried to show here is the importance of biblical teaching that we are made in the image of likeness and likeness of God, just by looking at one piece of what it means to be the image of God, the one piece of the social implications of being made in the image of God, by looking at those who've done away with some of these claims that that we're all equal with each other in God's sight as our most basic value. I've also tried to show that our topic, the nature and status of humanity, is super important now in our world and will be probably even more so in years to come. It's not so much that only the church is at stake and vulnerable. Democratic society itself is highly vulnerable without this truth as one of its major foundation stones. I don't like to trust myself to the predictions of futurologists, even if those futurologists, like this guy, is a historian. That makes him a little bit safer in my mind, but in my prejudices. But, as I say, I don't like to trust them, because our real trust in all this, and here I'll end, is got to be in God and in his providence and in his ability to guide us one day at a time. We must think the big picture, we must look to the future, we must be able to live one day at a time and really honor him in our prayers and in our valuing, our putting into our own lives the truth that we've been talking about this morning. I'll stop here, and as we break now, okay. Yes.
So we're going to take, I'm going to try and keep this on schedule, so we're going to take about a 20-minute break. There's coffee, tea, and some snacks out here. There's some banana bread that does have nuts. There's some blueberry bars that do not have nuts. So stretch your legs, go to the bathroom, grab something to drink, and we will be back.